The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to Postcards for the final episode in this series. Now, this week I'm really excited to be joined by the one and only Clara Amfo. So Clara is probably best known for hosting the mid-morning show on Radio 1, for doing red carpet interviews at film premieres, and also for her TV coverage of festivals like Glastonbury. But she's also got some killer travel stories to share. So in this episode, Clara tells me about how Notting Hill Carnival inspired her love for music. She delves into her earliest memories of Ghana, the country where her parents were born, and she talks me through an unfathomably psychedelic photo taken in Tokyo. As always, you can see all of her photographs online. The link is in the show notes. I started by asking Clara how she's finding lockdown.
For me personally, I have been extremely blessed to still be able to work, but I've spent a lot of time doing a lot of overthinking, if I'm being completely honest.
Where are you? You're London. You're based in London, right?
Yeah, so I live in East London, isolating alone, which I'm really happy about. Just saying to a friend the other day, like, I couldn't think of anything worse than living with somebody right now. Or like, you know, like, shout out to everybody who is in functioning, healthy relationships. I love it. And I'm very much here for still maintaining flirts and online dating in, you know, loving the time of Corona, as they say. But I'm happy that I'm at least living by myself. I think that's been the best option for me.
But it's been a weird time. It's been a weird time for everyone.
Yeah, man. But this is it. I think, yeah, exactly. So I think it's just been that thing of like sort of reaffirming, I guess, what maybe you already knew, or being forced to confront what you've been trying to ignore, because what else are you going to do when you're stuck in the house? Do you know what I mean?
That's it. And I guess that's why we're doing this podcast. So the idea is we want to give people a bit of escapism when they're locked indoors. Obviously, we're actually not locked indoors anymore, but there's still a lot of places we can't travel to. So should we go on to your first postcard?
Sure.
Which is a photograph of you in Ghana. Could you describe it to me in as much kind of vivid detail as possible?
So I'm in Jamestown in Ghana, and I'm playing table football against a group of four kids. They did beat me, but don't watch that. On the table football setup, there's a sign that says no gambling. And yeah, it's just very vibrant and very sort of, this is a great sort of postcard for what Ghana is. I think it's just openness, friendliness. I mean, the Ghanaian catchphrase is akwaba, which means you are welcome. Anywhere you go, people always say akwaba, akwaba, akwaba. So you can just start playing table football with a bunch of kids and they will entertain you.
And what brought you there? Were you visiting family?
Absolutely. So I am Ghanaian on both sides. I visit Ghana quite a lot. So Ghana is a place that is super, super, super fun around Christmas and New Year's Eve. It's the place to be. I mean, you know, it has been said it is the Miami/Ibiza of West Africa. last year going into this year in particular was an absolute riot. And part of me almost doesn't want to go back because the last time I went was essentially so perfect. I mean, the thing about Ghana is that it is bursting with colour. That's what I love about it. Like, it's just bursting with heat. I mean, literally, the minute you step off the plane, your face is just assaulted with humidity. And I love it. I love landing at Kotoko Airport. It makes me feel so good. Because even though I was brought up in the UK, I feel as Ghanaian as I do British, to be honest. There's just a whole feeling that I get when I'm there.
I want to pick up on that in a moment, but first, there's something I have to ask, because you describe Ghana as being like a West African answer to Miami or Ibiza. What's a night out look like for you in Accra?
Yeah, the nightlife is crazy. Like, you've got to pace yourself. So there's a really good spot in Ghana called Republic Bar, which is so cool. And that's like open like 7 days a week. And I have a really good karaoke night and it spills out into the street. And like, they serve absolutely lethal cocktails. Drink measures in Ghana are, they're kind of obsolete, to be honest. It's just a bit like, yeah, come on, come on, come on, drink, 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 drink. they've got this particular cocktail that's just got like, this has got pure ginger in it, I think, like with rum, and it will literally burn like the eyes out of your skull, but it's still quite fun to attempt to drink it.
Yeah. What's the music scene like in Accra?
The music scene in Accra is incredible. I mean, it's always been there, and it's not like it needs sort of like, you know, Western approval, but I'd be lying if I said it hasn't warmed my heart to see how the music of, I mean, of just of Africa in general, but particularly Ghana, has just really picked up like worldwide. Like you saw in the last like Beyonce record, her sort of ode to her relationship with sort of exploring like sub-Saharan Africa. And like, you know, she got some Ghanaian artists involved on that. I mean, like, there's this guy called like Chata Wale, and he's sort of like a Ghanaian sort of like dancehall artist. He's like huge, and his music was playing there loads. There's this kid called Kwesi Arthur, who's huge out there, and like his music's like banging. Like, you could just hear him out of every single car. Girl, when I'm in love with you, and I don't want nobody, I don't want.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about was, do you have any like earliest memories of traveling out to Ghana as a kid?
Yeah, I remember the first time I went was during like the summer holidays, and we went to go and stay in the village that my mum and dad are from. So it's a village called Jikiti, and it's in the northern region of Ghana, so it's like the Volta region. And I remember it being a little bit of a culture shock, because again, like going back to what I said at the start, like I definitely felt like, okay, this is my home, I belong here. But also I was a bit like, whoa, okay, this is different. Because I wasn't used to the way of life that my parents had grown up in. I remember we went back to the house that my dad was brought up in. I remember me and my little brother Chris and like four of my cousins all had to share a bed. and the electricity like went out at a certain time. And I remember just being like, where am I? Like just being a bit, yeah, just sort of feeling that sort of culture shock, but also just loving it as well, you know, just sort of seeing this rolling fields of green and like just seeing like, you know, the Volta River and just tasting like fresh coconuts. People will literally climb up a tree and like get you one, and my dad be like, yeah, hey, but like, you know, and it was just really like, wow, okay, this is part of who I am. And I think I didn't have quite the language to compute it at 11, 12 years old, but I just knew that it was quite cool that I had this whole sort of second other life just outside of like hanging out at my local shopping centre.
Should we move on to postcard number two?
Sure.
Which is of you at the Notting Hill Carnival. Can you describe it for the listener? What's going on in this scene?
So in the scene, I am stood outside a Trellick Tower with a massive goofy smile on my face in a vintage Machino yellow, red and black ensemble, just saying it's the most wonderful time of the year, because I genuinely have much more fun at Notting Hill Carnival than I do at Christmas. It's such a day of like vibrancy and peacocking and like showing out, and I just love Carnival. It just makes me feel so happy. I think it's just that one day of the year where all the people that you've been meaning to see just happen to bump into each other, and I'm so gutted it's been cancelled this year. I mean, obviously, it's understandable, and we all feared it, but we were hoping there was a way that it could be salvaged. But alas, it's off.
And what about when it returns? Hopefully, next year. Do you think it will come back stronger?
Absolutely. This is the thing. Everything that has been cancelled this year will only be sweeter next year. Because again, when you, it's, this time has been extremely bittersweet, but I think it's definitely that thing of when something has been taken away from you, out of your control, that you love to do just for like, you know, for pure liberation and for pure escapism, when it's offered back, you're going to run towards it. I mean, look how people were when the pubs reopened, when you could see your hairdresser again or whatever. It was like, oh my God, like, you see how people were so elated over that. So I think something like Carnival is going to be amazing.
Oh, I can picture it already.
But for the benefit of listeners who haven't been to Carnival before, can you describe that feeling of your first hour there when you get off the tube? Like, what are the sounds and smells and flavours of Carnival?
So when you first touch road at Carnival, like, you'll be hit with just everybody else's body heat as well as, like, the actual heat. But the first thing you will smell in the air, I mean, it's a very fragrant affair, but you'll be hit with the smell of the most well-marinated, well-seasoned, most delicious food you will ever smell in your life. And I think us as a nation should be forever indebted to people from the Caribbean. We know this. Shout out to the Windcrush crew all day, every day, for everything. But in this context, for cuisine and music, it overtakes you. Like, the food just smells so good. Like, I always make sure I go to Carnival hungry, because nothing beats some roadside jerk chicken with a side of coleslaw, like maybe some mac and cheese in there as well. It's an assault on the eyes and the ears in the best possible way, because you're hearing people's, like, whistles blowing. You're hearing, you know, people's sound systems, like, booming. Like, every corner is a sound clash, essentially, because as well as all the moving floats, you know, going through with all their dancers and all of that, people are blaring out music, you know, from their homes. People are blaring out stuff on their phones, even though I'm just like, oh, I'm like, sure, you know, I'll contribute, but, like, I'm not sure how loud your phone can be against, like, a proper sound system. And it's just amazing. And, yeah, just the colours. You know, it's like, it's a photographer's wet dream. I mean, like, you will see, like, every person out there with a 35mm camera thinking they're doing something different. But, like, sure, have at it. Every street corner is a gang of friends, like, taking a selfie. It's just a delight. I love it.
Because you're obviously a radio DJ on Radio 1. I wanted to ask if Carnival has been in any way kind of formative in you becoming a DJ or in your music tastes?
Yeah, I think definitely going to Carnival formed a lot of my tastes, and I inherited a lot of my musical tastes from my older brothers, and particularly my older brother Andy. He's been going to Carnival for years, so, like, anything that he would listen to, I would listen to. And I don't profess to be, like, an expert on Jamaican music in particular and dancing music in particular, but, you know, but I like what I like. Jamaica as a country, and just the history of, like, bass music, like, you know, whether it's grime, Gary, like, it, dubstep, you can trace so many of its roots back to that country. You can see the origins, and it's so fascinating to see how it is, you know, just part of popular culture.
Hearing you describe Carnival with such passion and colour, it actually brings me on to something else I wanted to talk to you about, which is your podcast, This City. Now, this is basically an interview show with a twist, because you get your guests to take you behind the scenes of the London that they know and love, sharing their favourite places and the stories behind them. Series 1 was launched in January, is that right? And you've had everyone from Louis Theroux to Mark Ronson to the Sugar Babes on the show. I've been enjoying it a lot, and I really wanted to know, is there more to come, Clara?
Yeah, so I'm currently working on season 2 because, lockdown happened, and I was a bit torn as to, oh, gosh, do I want to... I mean, I know me and you are talking down the line as you speak, but I love to see people. I love to actually be face-to-face with people. And actually, and ironically, even when I was recording the podcast, I was social distancing before it became a thing, because everyone I spoke to, we were actually at least 2 metres apart anyway. But I prefer to speak to people face-to-face. We are working on season 2 at the moment. But yeah, I think what I've been so happy about with all of the guests, and what we say at the start of the podcast, is that, look, whether you were born here or whether you've made it your second home, I just want to know about your London story. And I think we've been able to sort of have those conversations in it. I mean, I had Nchuti Gatwa on the show, who I love, And he plays Eric in the brilliant Sex Education. And his story was a London story, but it was via Rwanda and Scotland, which is a combination I think not a lot of people are probably, you know, used to hearing. But then, like, you know, I had Louis Theroux on it, and, you know, we had a really great conversation about him living in, like, Northwest around, like, Harleston, and had a very open conversation about, you know, gentrification and him decolonizing his palate. Gosh, who else did we speak to? I mean, we had Sugar Babes on, which I really enjoyed because, you know, we got Mutia, who's like Filipino and Irish, Siobhan, Irish, Keisha, Jamaican, and like they all had their all sort of individual sort of stories. So it was been a really cool way to just sort of, I guess, explore the kind of immigrant stories in London, which I've really enjoyed, as well as people who were born and bred here who aren't the sons and daughters of immigrants. So I've really liked exploring that, so that, yeah, there will be more to come.
I'm really glad to hear it. And for listeners who do want to check it out, search for This City wherever you're listening to this. Now, Clara, I'd like to touch on another aspect of your work. So as the listeners will know, you're a presenter on Radio 1. And in early June, you made a extremely powerful and really candid speech on your programme about the killing of George Floyd and the impact that it had on you as a person of colour. Now, obviously, this is a travel podcast, and so I was wondering, looking through that lens, if your own experiences travelling have impacted your thinking on racism at all? Like, do you have experiences of countries where it's more or less of a problem than it is here in the UK?
I'll tell you this. I don't know a single black person that hasn't Googled, like, okay, is it cool for black people around it? Like, before, it's just for me, in my circles anyway, like, it's just a conversation that, you know, that comes up. And, like, you know, there are blogs and accounts that are set up specifically with the black traveller in mind. Like, there's a great collective that I follow called, like, Travel Noir, who are really good. And, like, you know, if you look at the hashtag, like, travelling whilst black and holidaying whilst black, people do look up stuff because, you know, as I mentioned when I did speak, like, anti-blackness is a global thing. It's not just, you know, the US, and it's absolutely not just the UK. Like, anti-blackness is global. And I am very aware of that when I travel. Like, some places, there is a genuine curiosity to blackness, and other places, there's an out-and-out ignorance and an out and out hate towards you. So, you know, I remember one time I went to Croatia, and in the space of about a week, I was called Michelle Obama, Janet Jackson, Whoopi Goldberg, and this guy just used to call me, like, Rasta, like, every morning in the space of, like, 10 days. But, dude, that's what happens, man. Like, that's, you'd be hard pressed to find a black person who has travelled outside of the UK to a country where they haven't been given some sort of reductive nickname based on a black celebrity, or just been called a casual, I don't want to call it casual because there's nothing casual about it, but, you know, a racial slur. It's just the reality of travelling. But then I think it also depends where you go, because, you know, I went to Brazil a couple of years ago, and you know, and there's definitely, like, anti-black racism in Brazil. Like I said, it's the global thing. But one thing I love about traveling as a black woman is seeing, you know, the different types of black people all around the world, and the beauty of us globally. And I remember just loving Brazil because I just saw so many stunning black people. I was like, wow, like, I was just like, yeah, I love us. Like, you know, like, just, like, gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous black people. Yeah, because I remember, yeah, I went to Rocinha Favela, and loads of locals were, like, practicing for the carnival, and everyone was just really attractive. my profound takeaway. But yeah, all the black people in Brazil are, like, so hot, but, like, they are, like, beautiful.
Right. Well, it's now time for us to move about 10,000 miles west of Brazil, and onto our third and final photo, which is, I think, unmistakably in Tokyo. And you were the friend, both sitting in the laps of what looked like giant robot models of Japanese computer game characters. What on earth is going on here?
So in this picture, I'm with my mate Kobe, and we are at the robot restaurant. So basically, it's almost like a cosplay setup. So you remember, everyone knows Power Rangers, old school kids TV show. I mean, it's still going on. The robot restaurant is like that. So you will watch a full on theatrical production. And it is absolutely incredible. They will create like these giant sort of like dinosaur monster type figures, or like, I don't know, like an octopus on wheels, or like a flying tiger, or like a unicorn or whatever. And an actress or actor will be on top of it, like singing, you know, this over-dramatic like Japanese pop song to explain what's going on. And they'll stop, they'll act out a scene, and like there's fighting, and there's like pyrotechnics, and there's like confetti cannons. It's honestly, it's nuts. It's the bonkers side of Japan that you're told about, and it's insane, but it's so fun.
How do you find Japan more generally? Because obviously it's full of these kind of super intense futuristic experiences if you want to find them, but in other ways it's a country that's steeped in tradition.
I remember before I went, so I went in April of last year, and my mate Greg from work, Greg James, hosts the old Radio 1 breakfast show, he said Japan is like being in the past and being in the future all at the same time. And I was like, okay. And the minute I got there, I completely knew what he meant. It's a country that has maintained its sense of tradition in such a beautiful way that there are some places that seem like they haven't been touched since maybe, like, you know, 1950 in some cases. But it's also a country that is so far advanced with the simplest things that it just blows your mind. Like even the loo, like they got singing toilets there, man. They like heat your bum. And like you can pick, like you've got a selection of like 20 songs that you can listen to while you do your business or whatever. Like it's just mad. And like, you know, even the train stations, people actually queue in single file to get on the train. There's no rudeness there. And it's just, yeah, it's a stunning country.
Something that I discovered in Japan was city pop, which I didn't know much about before, but it's basically, it's kind of like 70s/80s, almost like funky disco that was kind of exported. It was Japan's interpretation of what was going on in the rest of the world at that time. And it is so good. It's honestly like, I got completely addicted to it and came back and only listened to it for months.
But that's the thing, like all the subcultures in Japan are so fascinating. Like there was this one spot that I went to with my friend Shalin, who lives in Japan. So she lives in Osaka, and she took me around lots of different spots. And there's this sort of like mall where basically every floor or every room has got a different theme. So you could like, you could walk into like one room and it's like a Rocky Horror Show themed bar. And then you walk next door and then it's like, oh, we all want to dress up as giant cats in here. And then you walk into another room and it's like, oh yes, we're all women who like to dress up as like businessmen. Like there's just a different scene like in every single door. It was again, so bizarre. Are, but just brilliant.
Quite a nice way of describing it. I've read someone describe it as being like a cultural Galapagos.
Exactly. A cultural Galapagos. That's spot on.
So this trip was last year?
April of last year, yeah.
I was going to ask, like, as we start to emerge from lockdown and travel is now back on the cards again, is there anywhere that you're really fantasizing of going to next?
I'd like to go to Fiji. I'd like to go to Senegal. I've heard great things about Senegal. I'd really, really, really like to go. I mean, look, there's so much of Africa that I want to visit. I really want to go to Egypt. The list is kind of endless. And I rarely repeat countries. So I think once I've been somewhere and I've locked it in, I don't feel the need to go again. But there is something about Jamaica that I do love, and I would like to go back because it's genuinely like quite magical. There's a mysticism in the air that I can't put my finger on. I've been there three times now, and I probably will go for a fourth because it's just a really stunning country.
Clara, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you for sharing your postcards.
Love and respect.
That was Clara Amfo. And that is a wrap
for Series 1 of Postcards. If you enjoyed this episode and you haven't heard what came before, we actually have 6 other episodes for you to get your teeth, or ears rather, into. You can take your pick from Kate Humble, Griff Rhys-Jones, Marcel Theroux, Steve McCurry, Adi Adepitan and Miriam Margolyes. They're all, in my opinion, superb guests and well worth a listen. And there might be one more very special guest coming your way in just a few weeks' time. So stay subscribed to this feed and you won't miss that bonus episode. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on this world tour of the imagination while travel has been temporarily off the cards. Have a wonderful summer, however you plan to spend it.
Postcards is presented by Greg Dickinson and produced by Pete Norton and Theodora Laloudis. If you enjoyed the show, do leave a rating and a review where you're listening, or tell a friend about the podcast. And remember that you can see all of the photos discussed in this episode online via the link in the show notes. Thanks very much for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.